76-year-old Walter Page was a pillar of the community in Manchester, New Hampshire. A resident for nearly 50 years, he and his wife Faye had built their home, raised a family, and were now slowing down to enjoy a little more of their golden years. Just a week before Christmas, however, in December of 1995, a series of threatening phone calls and a fiery attack would forever change their lives. Walter had been a member of several Masonic lodges throughout his life, serving as a member, master, and treasurer. A stockbroker with expertise in investment banking, Walter continued handling the Washington Lodge's books even after he stepped down after 25 years. In recent years, several scandals had rocked the Masonic Association, leading to arrests and convictions in two separate cases. Now, Walter believed, he might be on to a third. Following a meeting with then-treasurer of the lodge, Carl Bickford, as well as the president of the association, Conrad Ekdahl, disturbing things began happening. Ekdahl arrived home to find a homemade incendiary device wedged against his front door. Walter, among others, received a threatening call alluding to a bombing at his home. While police worked to track down the identity of their would-be arsonist, the unthinkable happened. A massive fire exploded at the Page home. By the time the blaze was under control, Walter's body was found in his basement office. No one expected that his autopsy report would show that he had been viciously stabbed to death before the fire was set. Detectives were now faced with a difficult question. Had Walter been targeted by a stranger due to his connection to one of the previously litigated cases, or was it possible his murder had been carried out by someone he knew in order to prevent the discovery of a yet unknown crime? This is Trace Evidence, Episode 190, The Murder of Walter Page. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we examine the brutal, unsolved 1995 murder of Walter Page. Before getting into the case, just a few quick notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances. You can follow the show on social media on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or by searching Facebook for Trace Evidence. If you're interested in supporting the show and getting some Trace Evidence merch, there's a Patreon at patreon.com/traceevidence, or you can donate directly via PayPal. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, donation options, and contact information. You can submit case suggestions through the website or email me directly at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. This year, CrimeCon will be taking place in Las Vegas, Nevada, and I'll be there representing Trace Evidence on Podcast Row. If you're planning to attend, you can use promo code TRACE to save 10% off your ticket. For more information, visit CrimeCon.com, and remember to use promo code TRACE to save 10%. I look forward to seeing you there. 76-year-old Walter Page was a well-known and respected member of the Manchester community. He was an experienced financier, devoted family man, and considerate neighbor. His brutal murder shocked friends and family and left the community reeling in search of justice, which remains unclaimed more than 25 years later. This is Episode 190, The Murder of Walter Page. On a bitterly cold morning in Manchester, New Hampshire, smoke billowed up from dozens of chimneys as heavy clumps of wet snow fell from graying skies. In the city's north end, along Walnut Hill Avenue, stood an old gray Cape Cod-style home with white shutters. It had been there for 45 years and was the family home of Walter and Faye Page. There they had raised their children, celebrated countless birthdays and holidays, and even their own 50th wedding anniversary. It seemed the house would always be there, passed down through generations, where all the love and memories of the family would continue to grow. Then, less than a week before Christmas in 1995, tragedy struck. Multiple fire departments responded to the call of a house fire. Arriving at the Page residence, they were overwhelmed by the ferocity of the blaze. The entire first floor was consumed while thick plumes of dark smoke poured out from a gaping hole in the roof, with massive flames erupting out. It was a difficult fire, knocking firefighters to the ground as they struggled to gain control of the inferno that absolutely gutted the home. No one was worried about the mementos and knickknacks, but the family patriarch who was trapped inside. When the smoke cleared and investigators were able to dig through the ashes, they made a grisly discovery. There, in what had once been the home's basement office, lie the body of 76-year-old Walter Page. Under normal circumstances, this would have been tragic enough, but Walter's death wasn't as simple as an accidental fire growing out of control. It was quickly determined that arson had been responsible. Police had been made aware of a bombing threat Walter had received just the day before. Several other residents had gotten phone calls from an unidentified assailant who threatened to blow up their homes and burn down their lives. When the autopsy showed that Walter had been stabbed to death before his home was set ablaze, investigators realized they were dealing with something far more dangerous than a series of threatening phone calls, and they worried about who in the community might be next. Walter Harriman Page was born on Monday, July 21, 1919, in Marblehead, Massachusetts, to parents William and Mariette. At the time of his birth, Walter's father was 22 and working as a manager at a shoe store, while his mother was 21 and listed on census data as a homemaker. Over the course of the next decade, Walter would become an older brother, having two younger brothers and one younger sister. During that span of time, his father would go on to launch his own shoe manufacturing company, Osceola, which operated in Massachusetts and New Hampshire. Walter grew up in a tight-knit household which instilled in him the value of family, something which would remain his primary focus throughout life. His parents enjoyed traveling, and so Walter would get to see more of the world outside of the United States through his early childhood. Intelligent from a young age, Walter's early education came at the prestigious Tower School in Marblehead, today one of the oldest independent schools in the Boston area. He performed well academically, attending kindergarten through eighth grade at the school. In 1933, he moved on to Phillips Academy, a boarding school in Andover where his father had also attended. Noted for being difficult to get into, the academy historically accepts only 13% of applicants. Graduating from Phillips Academy in 1938, Walter moved on to Yale University, again following in his father's footsteps. William had graduated from Yale just months before Walter's birth. While attending, Walter became a member of the Alpha Sigma Phi fraternity, as well as joining in the university's ROTC program, becoming a member of the Yale Naval Society. 4 years later, in 1942, Walter graduated with a Bachelor of Science. Upon completion of university, Walter followed his path into the Navy, where he reported to the USS Swanson, a destroyer, at the end of June in Casco Bay, Maine. From there, his ship was headed towards Scotland by way of Halifax. According to naval records and interviews with Walter himself, during his time on the Swanson, he served as an assistant torpedo officer, assistant communications officer, and assistant gunnery officer. In July of 1943, Walter left the Swanson and headed to Seattle, Washington, where he spent a month training the torpedo and depth charge crews of his new ship, the USS Thompson, in Keyport. From there, he'd be involved in shore bombardment training exercises and would sail to Africa, Aruba, Trinidad, Boston, and Norfolk, among other places. Perhaps the most jarring experience for Walter during World War II occurred in May of 1945, when his ship came under attack by multiple Imperial Japanese kamikaze fighters, and his team was credited with shooting down 15 Japanese aircraft. As early as 1943, according to local newspaper records, Walter had met and begun a relationship with Faye McChesney of Troy, New York. On leave back in Massachusetts, Walter and Faye visited often, and 2 years later, in March of 45, the couple's engagement was announced. Faye was listed as having attended Emma Willard School, Russell Sage College, and Catherine Gibbs School in New York. This same announcement made note that Walter had seen 2 years of active service, and as of that time, was stationed in the Pacific War Zone. 5 months later, in August of 45, Walter came home on leave, returning to Marblehead where Faye joined him. 1 month later, on Saturday, September 15th, the wedding took place at the little church around the corner in New York. Following the ceremony, Walter and Faye left on a short honeymoon, and upon their return announced they would settle into number 2 Page Road in Marblehead. Beginning in 1946, Walter and Faye started building their family, which would grow to include 3 children, 2 sons, Todd and Rick, and a daughter, Danette. During this period of time, the family were living in Salem, Massachusetts, but as the 1950s began, Walter became the president of the Danvers Shoe Company, and in 1951, the family picked up stakes, moving to the north end of Manchester, New Hampshire. According to Danette, at the time, the north end was primarily made up of pastures and farmland. Walter and Faye had a Cape Cod-style home with a 2-car garage built along Walnut Hill Avenue. This would be only the second house built along that street. It'd be in this home that Walter and Faye would raise their children and where the couple would live together for the next 44 years. In an interview with the New Hampshire Union Leader, Danette described her childhood by saying, quote, "We were all very, very close. I had a wonderful family life growing up in Manchester," end quote. She described her father as full of spit and vinegar, always ready to get things going and frequently rushing to get them done. Working in stocks and investments, Walter was often busy trying to close deals, and business was never far from his mind. However, he always put family before anything else, and it was important to him that they spent all the time together they could, especially during the holidays. His son Todd would later explain that Christmas was his father's favorite time of year. In 1960, Walter became the president of Tucker Anthony, an independent investment and banking firm working out of Nashua, just 20 miles south of Manchester. Walter would continue working for Tucker Anthony for the next 35 years, until his untimely death. Around this same time, Faye picked up work at Manpower, the third largest staffing company in the world. Outside of work, the couple were very active, enjoying golf and tennis in particular, going so far as to have their own tennis court constructed in their backyard. They'd go on to create what became known as the Page Colony Club, a backyard tennis club where they challenged friends and neighbors to compete. As a result, both maintained excellent physical shape and lived healthy lifestyles. Beyond work and tennis, both Faye and Walter were heavily involved in the local community. Walter was a Mason and would join Washington Lodge No. 61. Over time, he would serve there as a member, a master, and treasurer, where he'd ultimately receive the Sullivan Award for his dedication to the lodge. According to his obituary, Walter would also go on to be a member and officer of the Mount Horeb, Chapter 11, Royal Arch Masonry, Trinity Commandery, and New Hampshire Consistory, 32nd Degree Valley of Nashua, the Bektesh Temple, and the Manchester Shrine Club. He's also noted as being a former member and past president of the Manchester Exchange Club, as well as having held memberships in the Currier Gallery of Art, the Manchester Historic Association, the Manchester Institute of Arts and Science, Strawberry Bank Museum, and the Algonquin Tennis Club. Over the course of the next 30 years, Walter established himself as a pillar of the community, a trusted confidant, and a financial expert who frequently offered his assistance for several Masonic lodges as pertained to their investments in banking. When he began serving as treasurer in the mid-1960s for the Washington Lodge, he took over an account of approximately $50,000 and managed to transform that into several hundred thousand. Even after stepping down from his position as treasurer after 25 years, he continued to help manage financial accounts, balance out the books, and provided advice on how to continue growing the portfolio. In July of 1995, Walter turned 76 years old. By this point in life, he and Faye were enjoying their golden years, though they certainly hadn't showed signs of slowing down. The children had all moved out by then and were building their own families, which the couple relished in, especially when it came to showering their grandchildren with love and attention. Walter continued to work for Tucker Anthony, and while Faye had retired from Manpower a decade earlier, after 25 years of service, she kept herself busy volunteering for the library, among others. Faye had always been heavily involved in gardening and was known throughout the community for her ability to grow anything, and she'd often utilize that skill to teach others or help provide rewards for community events. In late October, Walter and Faye gathered with their family to hold a celebration marking the two very special occasions, Faye's 75th birthday and the couple's 50th wedding anniversary. It was a time of great joy that brought everyone together. In retrospect, the happy memories of that celebration would become bittersweet as an unimaginable nightmare loomed just around the corner. At the time, no one could have ever imagined that just 2 months later in December, Walter would become the victim of a brutal and violent murder that would take not only his life, but the very home he and his wife had shared for the previous 45 years. On Tuesday, December 12, 1995, a meeting was scheduled to take place at Walter's home. Attending would be Carl Bickford, then treasurer of the Manchester Masonic Service Association, as well as Conrad Ekdahl, then president of the association. This meeting had been arranged to discuss how they wanted to invest money from the association, a sum totaling approximately $109,000. However, before the meeting could take place, two very strange things happened. Firstly, while examining the books, Walter discovered something that raised his eyebrows. Bank records showed that there had been an overdraft fee on the association's account in the amount of $5,000. Considering the large amount of money that should have been in the account, it didn't make any sense. Now, while it's never directly stated, it seems implied that when arranging this meeting, Walter mentioned to Bickford and Ekdahl that he'd found some inconsistencies. Secondly, on the 12th, before the meeting took place, Walter received a bizarre phone call at his home. He couldn't identify the caller, who he described as sounding either like a man pretending to be a woman or a woman pretending to be a man. According to the union leader, the unknown caller threatened Walter, telling him that they were going to blow up his house or send him a bomb for the role he had played in the arrest and conviction of René Lemire. Months earlier, René Lemire had been arrested and charged with embezzling $56,000 from the Masonic home, a retirement home in Manchester that was developed to provide a place for Masons and their families should they need one as age advanced. While Lemire himself was not a Mason, he had been employed at the home. Through access to Social Security and Medicare funds, Lemire was able to take nearly $60,000 over a time frame spanning several years in the early 90s. Lemire's troubles didn't end there, as further investigation showed he'd played a role in another embezzlement scheme, this time working hand-in-hand with his wife, Faith Yanez Lemire. At the time, Faith was employed by the Hillsborough County Superior Court, and together, the couple had managed to steal $41,000 from that institution. Arrested and charged with these crimes, both René and Faith would ultimately make deals, pleading guilty to lesser charges. The very same day Walter received the threatening phone call on December 12th, Lemire was sentenced to 4.5 to 7 years in prison for the money he'd stolen from the Masonic home. Perhaps what made the call even stranger than it already was the fact that Walter hadn't played any role in Lemire's arrest and conviction. He hadn't been involved in the financials of the Masonic home, and while he was aware of the case, he was in no way connected to it. He had, however, been previously involved in a different embezzlement investigation. According to the Boston Globe, 1 year earlier in 1994, Leonard Newall Sr., a Mason and former master of the Lafayette Masonic Lodge, had been arrested and charged with stealing dues that had been paid to several Masonic organizations. According to court records, these thefts took place between February of 1989 and January of 92. While the prosecution ultimately accused Newall of stealing just under $62,000, Nathaniel Foss, the president of the Masonic Temple Association, argued that the stolen money was likely closer to between $100,000 and $130,000. Unfortunately, records, which would have allowed an exact figure to be determined, were destroyed along the way, and so they couldn't prove exactly how much money Newall had taken. For his part, Newall argued that he'd stolen far less than what he was accused of, saying it was closer to between $10,000 and $15,000. Walter had been involved in this investigation, in so much as he had supplied investigators with financial documents connected to the Masons. According to investigators and the district attorney's office, he hadn't had any more involvement than supplying records, and certainly wasn't the person who had discovered the money was missing. Newell would ultimately be sentenced to serve 90 days in prison in order to pay back $10,300 in restitution. By the time of the threatening phone call, Newell had already served his time and had been released. So, to say Walter was a bit confused may be an understatement, but as it turned out, he wasn't the only person receiving threatening calls that day. John Williams had closer ties to the Lemire case than Walter. He was president of the Masonic Home Trustees at the time Lemire's embezzlement was discovered. Shortly after the crimes came to light, Williams resigned from the board and was no longer associated with the Masonic Home. He also received a threatening phone call, and while the details have never been released, it's been hinted that the content of the call was similar to Walter's, threatening him for his involvement in the arrest and prosecution of Rene Lemire. Asked about the threat Walter received, Nathaniel Foss couldn't understand why he'd have been threatened over Lemire at all, telling the union leader, quote, "As for the threat to Page, that person didn't know what they were talking about because he didn't have anything to do with it," end quote. Later in the evening on the 12th, both Conrad Ekdahl and Carl Bickford arrived at Walter's home for the financial meeting. The three men ultimately decided to take $109,000 from the association's account and write a check out to Tucker Anthony, where Walter worked, to make an investment. Bickford, then treasurer, held the checkbook, so it was he who wrote and signed the check. During this meeting, Walter raised the question of the $5,000 overdraft, but neither Bickford nor Ekdahl had any idea of how it could have happened. Walter asked if he could look through the checkbook, and Bickford handed it over, where Walter quickly realized that at least one check was missing, though Carl didn't have an answer to why nor what it could have been written for. Determined to get to the bottom of things, Walter intended to begin digging into the account to figure out what exactly was going on. Following the conclusion of the meeting that night, both Conrad and Carl left Walter's home, assuming that, minus the overdraft fee, everything was fine, and the check for $109,000 was on its way to Tucker Anthony Investments, where it would be placed into a money market account. However, before the night was over, the unknown caller would strike, though the target turned out to be someone who hadn't received any phone calls. At the time, Conrad Ekdahl lived along Somerville Street, approximately 4 miles south of Walter's home. Upon arriving home that night, after the meeting, Ekdahl approached his house and upon opening the storm door, found the fizzling remains of a Molotov cocktail wedged between the main entry door and the screen door. The device had failed to detonate fully due to a lack of oxygen. Having been wedged between the two doors, it wasn't able to fully ignite, so instead it had burned itself out. Investigators would later state that the Molotov cocktail had been made by filling an empty root beer bottle with lamp oil. A cloth wick had then been inserted and lit before the device was placed between the doors. Ekdahl notified the police, who were able to take the incendiary device into their possession, as well as performing sweeps of the home to ensure no other traps had been left. At the time, no one was sure what was going on. Ekdahl hadn't been threatened, and even if he had, just like Walter, he wasn't involved in the Lemire case. There were two ways of looking at it. Either this had been a very poor attempt to firebomb Ekdahl's home, or maybe it had been a scare tactic never designed to actually cause the home to go up in flames. Either way, the Manchester police decided to keep an eye on Ekdahl and his home. The next day, on Wednesday, December 13th, Walter picked up his phone and called the Manchester police. During this call, he notified authorities of the threat he'd received about his home potentially being bombed. Considering the incident that had occurred with Ekdahl the night before, investigators took the threat very seriously and began working to try and track down the caller. Considering both Walter and Ekdahl's positions with the Masons, they began to believe someone was specifically targeting Masons. And given the details of the call Walter had received, it seemed likely that it was someone seeking revenge for the prosecution of Lemire. Considering how the attempt on Ekdahl's home had failed, they didn't believe they were working with anyone who had expertise or knowledge of incendiary devices, but in order to ensure everyone would be safe, they decided to issue a bulletin for the following morning, telling patrol units to check on both homes periodically over the course of the next few days. They could never have imagined what would happen next. Thursday, December 14th, was a cloudy, bitterly cold day in Manchester. Heavy, wet snow fell but failed to accumulate as temperatures struggled to reach a high of just 18 degrees. Walter and Faye woke in their gray Cape Cod home with plans for the day. Faye would be attending a meeting in town for her Christmas garden club, while Walter was focused on going down into his basement office to work on finding the source of the $5,000 overdraft on the Mason's account and any other irregularities. Wishing her husband good luck with his searching, Faye left the couple's home heading in for her meeting. Neither she nor Walter had any idea this would be the last moment they would ever share together. At approximately 3 p.m., a neighbor living along Walnut Hill Avenue observed smoke and flames emanating from the Page family home. The Manchester Fire Department responded quickly, though by the time they arrived, the house had become a searing inferno. Aware that someone might be trapped inside, firefighters approached the front door but were quickly thrown back from the blaze. They stared through the raging flames into the house but couldn't gain access, being pushed back by the intense heat. Quickly, they began unfurling hose lines and fighting the fire, which by this point had completely consumed the ground level of the house, and massive flames had erupted through the roof. It would later be determined that in the basement of the home, there were two 250-gallon fuel oil tanks, and one had ruptured, exploding with massive force. As a result, those parts of the home that were not completely destroyed by fire and water damage were drenched in a thick pool of oil, which rose to several inches high along the floor. The oil had spread so densely, the family would later need to hire an environmental company to clean up the spill. Before the fire was completely under control, Faye pulled onto her street and saw a massive barrage of fire engines, police vehicles, and emergency medical services. Danette later explained the experience to WMUR Channel 9, saying, quote, "My mom was an avid gardener, and she was at her annual Christmas garden club party, and came back, and she said she was just thrown back by the acrid smoke. She knew immediately that my father was in there, and that it wasn't good." End quote. While Faye frantically explained to firefighters that her husband was in the house, they unfortunately couldn't gain entry until they could get the fire under control. By the time the final flames were put out, they knew the likelihood of anyone inside surviving was essentially nil. Once they made their way through the scorched remnants of the structure searching for Walter, they would ultimately find his body on the floor in the basement office. Faye was absolutely devastated. Her husband of 50 years, the father of her children, the man she had loved for most of her life, was gone. The moment the Manchester police became aware of a fire at Walter's home, their suspicions were immediately aroused. Just one day earlier, they'd been made aware of a threat to bomb the home, and now it had been completely consumed in a massive fire. After the Molotov cocktail had been found at Ekdahl's home, they believed they were dealing with someone dangerous, but they never imagined it would lead to murder. What they didn't know at the time, however, was just how cold and calculating the arsonist had been. Considering the threatening call Walter had received, one of the first places investigators turned their attention to was Rene Lemire. While both he and his wife Faith were at the time incarcerated, it had to be determined whether or not they had knowledge of or were directly involved in a plot to kill Walter and potentially other members of the Masons. The first person they went to see was Jeffrey Yanez, Faith's son from a previous relationship, who looked at Lemire as his father. Speaking to the union leader, Jeffrey explained, quote, "They were at my house at 6:30 that same night, so I was one of the first suspects for what, I don't know. I would never think of doing something that horrific. My parents' attorney said it would be a great way for someone to cover up the truth by just naming my father. My parents aren't murderers. It's an unfortunate thing my mother and father had nothing to do with. They admitted their wrongdoings. They've paid for their wrongdoings. I just wish we could all just get on with our lives." End quote. At the same time, Jeffrey was concerned that he might be a target. According to the union leader, the same night Walter was killed, a car of the same make and model as the one Jeffrey owned was set ablaze outside of his apartment building. Had that been coincidence? Or was it possible that whoever was targeting the Masons was also targeting those close to Lemire? While investigators questioned Jeffrey, they asked for and were given permission to search his vehicle, but nothing was found. After determining that Jeffrey couldn't have been involved with the fire at the Page house, Police spoke to both Renee and Faith, though they both denied any involvement in or knowledge of anyone seeking revenge for their arrests. They noted at the time that, as far as they knew, Walter hadn't been involved in their cases, so it wouldn't have made any sense to target him in the first place. The next person detectives focused in on was Leonard Newell. Walter had been involved in that case, though only to a minor level, but still, they had to cover all their bases. Newell, however, didn't make a lot of sense. He'd already served his sentence, paid restitution, and was moving on with his life. When questioned about his potential involvement, Newell denied being connected in any way, saying that while, yes, he had stolen money, he'd admitted to it and paid the price. He wasn't a murderer, and even if he were, he had nothing against Walter, later telling reporters, quote, "Paige and I were friends. We were friends for years," end quote. Fairly early in the investigation, detectives began to wonder about the call Walter had received. With the unknown caller concealing their identity and trying to disguise their voice, they started to question the reason behind the threats. Was the arsonist truly targeting people because of their connection to Lemire's case, legitimate or imagined, or was it possible that someone was using that as a cover story to send detectives on a wild goose chase? Quickly, they began to develop a theory that targeting Walter and Ekdahl, who were in no way connected to Lemire, might have nothing to do with the previous embezzlement scam, but maybe one that had not yet been found. Investigators had already spoken to Ekdahl, not just because of the Molotov cocktail, but because he was present at the meeting with Walter 2 days before his death. For his part, Ekdahl couldn't think of anyone who might want to harm him or Walter, nor could he understand why anyone would think either man had been involved in the Lemire case. The next people investigators thought to speak to were Carl Bickford and his wife Bonnie. According to court documents, the Bickfords were interviewed about the fire later that evening, but neither seemed to have any knowledge of who might have been behind it or why Walter would have been targeted. Unsure of what exactly they were dealing with or who might be next in line for the arsonist's attack, investigators would receive 2 shocking pieces of information. On Friday, December 15th, an autopsy was performed on Walter. At the time, it was assumed that his cause of death would be determined to be connected to the fire, but the pathologist quickly discovered that the fire itself may have been set to cover up evidence of an even more vicious crime. According to the report, Walter had died not due to the fire, but instead had been stabbed at least 12 times. It seemed that someone had gained entry to the Page home, encountered Walter in the basement, and stabbed him 12 times before setting the fire, which would ultimately consume the house. While this shed new light on the investigation, it also presented a massive problem. Between the fire, the oil, and the water, all physical evidence connected to the murder had been destroyed. While they now had a cause of death, they didn't know where the murder weapon was, and there was nothing in the house they could use to try and narrow down a suspect. Fingerprints, fibers, DNA had all gone up in smoke. Now investigators had something else they needed to figure out. Had the killer broken into the home and ambushed Walter in his basement office, or was the killer someone Walter knew, someone he may have arranged a meeting with for that afternoon, or perhaps someone who just came by and was let in? The more they looked at the case, the more it began to seem like there was a lot of deception. Had the phone call threat been a cover to direct police towards Lemire? Had the killer been someone Walter knew well enough to let into his home? Most importantly, was the killer someone who wasn't concerned about Lemire but was trying to stop Walter before he could uncover evidence of their own involvement in a yet undiscovered embezzlement scheme? Given the direction those questions lead, theories split off in 2 directions. Either someone was targeting Masons in the area who were directly tied to the association's finances, or someone on the inside was trying to cover up their own crimes. While police were reeling with this new information, they'd get yet another call that caused alarm. Another man directly connected to the Masons, who has never been identified, received a threatening phone call that Friday afternoon. While the exact details of this call haven't been revealed, Nathaniel Foss later told the Boston Globe that the caller said, in part, "That's one down, and now you're next." Investigators immediately sent officers to watch over the person who had received the new threat while in the Masonic community, Fear and panic began to grow as they worried they'd all be targeted by the killer. Unsure of what was going on, Foss explained, quote, "We're looking for a link. These people have no connection at all to each other, except they knew each other as Masons, and there are 300 or 400 Masons down here. It's totally baffling because there are no links. That's what's so frightening. We're nervous, and we're all being very careful. If you had a good friend murdered, you'd be nervous too." End quote. That Friday, while investigators were attempting to narrow down a potential list of suspects, one person made their job extremely easy. We'll get into that after a few quick notes from this week's sponsors. I wish these bags under my eyes would just go away. If that sounds like you every morning, you're not alone. Bags and puffiness under the eyes are a problem for millions of Americans. Until now. Introducing GenuCell Plant Stem Cell Therapy to visibly reduce puffiness under the eyes. Anyone who's met me in person or watched a live stream knows this is something I struggle with. I've had bags under my eyes for years, and no matter what I've done, I've never been able to get them under control. I've been using GenuCell for a month now, and I've got to admit, I'm really surprised by the results. Twice a day after washing my face, I apply GenuCell to the bags under my eyes, and each time I watch as the skin firms up and the bags just melt away. I love how it lasts for a full 24 hours, so whether I'm just having lunch with friends or heading in for a long business meeting, I don't have to worry about looking tired and droopy. Having such an amazing experience, I've already been recommending GenuCell to all my friends and family. So you may be asking, why GenuCell? Like most people, you've probably tried numerous anti-aging skincare products, claiming to erase wrinkles, lighten dark circles under your eyes, brighten skin, and restore a more youthful appearance. No doubt you've been disappointed, but GenuCell products really work. GenuCell's anti-aging skincare products are based on antioxidants, natural substances proven to help repair and prevent damage caused by sun, wind, pollution, stress, and other external and internal factors. Their unique antioxidant skincare products are endorsed by doctors and celebrities. GenuCell promises results that'll make you smile, guaranteed, or you get 100% of your money back. Right now, GenuCell's most popular package is 60% off at GenuCell.com/trace. Treat yourself and a loved one to the absolute best skincare in the world. Just go to GenuCell.com/trace and enter my special promo code TRACE for a free gift plus an additional 20% off when you purchase their most popular package. Free priority shipping for a limited time, too. That's GenuCell.com/trace. GenuCell.com/trace. Has your mind been sprinting for years on end, leaving trails of stress, anxiety, and fatigue that are eroding your mental health? If you're nodding along yes, then it's time to adopt small daily practices that will have a huge impact on your long-term happiness and well-being. And it's easy to learn with Headspace. We all say fine when we don't mean it. Fine isn't really an emotion, is it? How many times have you told yourself you're fine when all you've really felt is anger or sadness or nerves? Headspace is scientifically proven to help you manage your feelings and mental health. In fact, a recent study proved in just 2 weeks, Headspace can reduce your stress by 14%. Whether you want to relieve stress and anxiety, sleep better, or improve your focus, Headspace is your everyday dose of mindfulness for real life. Whenever I'm feeling tired and stressed out, but know I struggle to fall asleep, I can always count on Headspace's sleep casts. They start with a gentle wind down like visualization or breathing exercises. Then I listen as a calming voice gives me detailed descriptions, providing a tour of an imaginary location. Best of all, it's paired with white noise to match that location, which really helps me get immersed and relaxed. On those nights where I just know I won't sleep, Headspace gets me there quickly and without the added stress of fighting against my pillow. However you're feeling, try Headspace at headspace.com/trace and get 1 month free of their entire mindfulness library. This is the best Headspace offer available. So go to headspace.com/trace today. Headspace.com/trace. Carl and Bonnie Bickford were set to attend a family dinner that Friday night, but Bonnie never showed up. Instead, she placed a call to her sister Martha, admitting that she had stolen approximately $109,000 from the account her husband was the treasurer of. The missing money was already coming to light, as the check Carl had written to Tucker Anthony on Tuesday bounced, showing that the account had essentially been cleaned out. Allegedly, during this call, Bonnie also admitted to having placed the Molotov cocktail at Ekdahl's home Tuesday night. Following the call, Bonnie fled from Manchester, and at the time, no one knew where she might be. Carl would receive a package in the mail which contained Bonnie's wedding ring and a letter admitting to her theft of the money, reading in part, quote, "To start, I did take the funds from the Services Association," end quote. The package also contained a letter addressed to the Manchester Police Department, as well as Bonnie's parents. Authorities were quickly notified by the family, and at that point, Bonnie became the prime suspect in Walter's murder. Warrants were issued for Bonnie's arrest based on her confession to the embezzlement, and police departments throughout New Hampshire, Vermont, Maine, Massachusetts, and New York were all notified to be on the lookout. A description of Bonnie, as well as her vehicle, were included in these notices. While the search for Bonnie kicked off, investigators began trying to track the history of her embezzlement, and considering his close relationship to her, Carl came under scrutiny as they worked to determine whether or not he may have been involved in the scheme or had knowledge of it. At the time, people were shocked by the possibility that Bonnie could have been involved in the embezzlement, let alone connected to a murder. Nathaniel Foss himself later expressed doubts to the Boston Globe, saying, quote, "There's no way in the world I could picture her being involved in any of this," end quote. Bonnie, 49 years old at the time, was known as a decent and upstanding woman in the community. She was a babysitter who had watched over many children in the area over the years, a consistent volunteer at the Goffstown Congregational Church, but now she was the prime suspect in a brutal homicide, arson, and embezzlement scam. Over that weekend, investigators worked hard to try and track down her location, but no one had seen her, or if they had, they weren't talking. Ultimately, while the fire had led police to Bonnie Bickford's door, it would be another fire that would result in her arrest. On Sunday, December 17th, police officers in the town of Weir, 20 miles northwest of Manchester, responded to a call regarding a car fire. Arriving along a back road, police found the vehicle of Bonnie Bickford had crashed off the side of the road and, somehow, the interior had caught fire. Weir Police Chief Ed Tuttle noted that upon arriving at the scene, officers had also found that pieces of tape had been used to alter the license plate of the vehicle in hopes of concealing the driver's identity. At the scene, they were able to identify the woman as Bonnie Bickford, though when questioned about the accident and the fire, Bickford claimed to have amnesia, not knowing who she was, where she was, or what had happened. When police ran the plates, they quickly learned that she had warrants out for her arrest and took her into custody, though she would stick to the amnesia act for several hours until eventually admitting it had all been a ruse. Bickford was quickly transferred back to Manchester, where for 7 hours she was interrogated about the embezzlement, the Molotov cocktail, the threatening calls, and the murder of Walter Page and the arson at his home. Bickford admitted to authorities that she'd stolen the money, planted the Molotov cocktail, and had made the threatening call to Walter the day before his murder. As pertained to the latter, however, she denied any involvement in either Walter's stabbing or the arson that destroyed the Page family home. On Monday, December 18th, Bickford was arraigned in Manchester District Court, where she faced charges of arson and embezzlement, though nothing related to Walter's death. Assistant Attorney General Joseph LaPlante requested a denial of bail, noting that she had admitted to trying to burn Ekdahl's house, saying, quote, "For that reason, her conduct is also viewed as having a connection to the Page homicide. She's very dangerous and a threat to the community," end quote. For the time at least, the judge agreed, and Bonnie was held without bail. One day later, on Tuesday, December 19th, a memorial service was held for Walter at Brookside Congregational Church. Hundreds of friends, family members, and prominent citizens of the area attended, with the church's parking lot being completely filled more than an hour before services began. Speaking of her father, Danette described him as proud, honorable, decent, intelligent. She talked of how he had devoted so much time to her growing up, ensuring she excelled in school. She thanked him for traits she had instilled in her, such as a love of travel, music, a strong sense of humor, and an appreciation for a good glass of wine. Danette's husband, Hugh, also spoke of Walter, saying, quote, "He had audacity, ingenuity, and wisdom. He was a war hero with piercing, liquid blue eyes," end quote. He went on to express how he saw Walter like a second father, describing a man whose honesty was unstoppable. Both of Walter's sons, Rick and Todd, also spoke, with Rick describing his father's intensity, while Todd focused on the fact that while Walter was never the type to ask for help, the family were asking the community to assist in seeing that the person responsible for his murder would be charged and jailed for the rest of their life. Heartbroken, Faye also spoke and went out of her way to thank the fire department and police for their efforts. She also thanked the victim witness services of the state's attorney general's office for the support they'd shown the family and for keeping them updated on the status of the investigation. 3 days later, on Friday, December 22nd, a bail hearing was held in Manchester District Court. Darcy Spence, Bickford's lawyer, argued that it was unfair to hold her without bond, noting that while there were suspicions about her potential involvement in Walter's murder, there was no evidence available that tied her to the crime or the crime scene. She argued that Bickford should be released due to her strong ties to the community, but Judge Norman Champagne disagreed, noting that Bickford posed a potential threat to the community and, given where she had been arrested, already showed a likelihood to flee if released. Ultimately, Judge Champagne ruled that Bickford would be held on $500,000 bail, which essentially ensured she wouldn't be getting out of jail anytime soon. Present that day in the courtroom were Bickford's husband, Carl, their son, Bonnie's parents, and two nieces. None of the family spoke in court that day, with the Boston Globe noting that while one of the nieces openly wept during the hearing, Carl and Bonnie never even looked at one another. Ronald Roy, a friend of Carl's, when asked for comment, admitted his surprise, saying, quote, "He's just a great guy. They're both peaches. We're in shock. We're just waiting for a reason, some way to understand why this might have happened," end quote. As for the Masons, Foss acknowledged that they were now having to reevaluate the way in which they handled finances, implementing new security measures and audit procedures to ensure this never happened again. 5 days later, on Wednesday, December 27th, another hearing was held after a grand jury chose to indict Bonnie. Bickford's attorney, Darcy Spence, requested that both her wedding ring and glasses be returned to her at that time, though the judge ruled against this, with the prosecutor stating that both items were considered evidence and were being tested to see if they could be tied to the Page murder and fire. According to the union leader, George M. Bahan, a chief investigator for the Criminal Bureau of the state's attorney general's office, testified that Bickford had faked bank documents related to the whereabouts of money belonging to the Masons. At the time, she was working as a babysitter and used her client's home computer to create fake documents. According to Bahan, the Masons were in possession of two certificates of deposit totaling $115,000. These deposit slips were kept in a safe deposit box at Manchester Municipal Employee Credit Union, a box to which both Carl and Bonnie had access. The man who had employed Bonnie as a babysitter told investigators that when he turned on his home computer, he found files with different numbers and letters in them. Bahan stated that the numbers found in these files were the same numbers on the deposit ticket. Bahan testified that Carl had told investigators he believed his wife cashed the Masons' CDs after they matured and put the money in a savings account at the Shawmut Bank. These CDs were for $57,000 and $48,000, respectively. Bonnie later purportedly transferred $109,649.23 to a checking account at the First New Hampshire Bank. The check Carl had written to Tucker Anthony the night of the meeting at Walter's house was drawn on this account. Bahan stated that Bonnie had given her husband letters from the bank showing the transactions had taken place, but these letters were discovered to be fraudulent. The Shawmut Bank stated that the employee listed on the letters was not a known employee of the bank, and that the deposit slip for First New Hampshire Bank was also fake. Bahan testified, quote, This was a fraudulent document. It was not a deposit slip, and this money was never deposited. End quote. Daniel Brennan, a detective with the Manchester Police, testified that Bonnie's sister Martha stated that four family members, including herself, were given $10,000 each by Bonnie, who claimed the money had come out of a relative's estate. Brennan explained that this $40,000 had not been a part of the estate, but instead had come directly from money paid to the Masonic home. Brennan further testified that when asked why she'd taken the money, Bonnie argued she needed it to stop her son from going to jail. But that made little sense, as Brennan explained her son was, quote, in good standing in the army, and there are no outstanding judgments against him. I don't know what to make of it. End quote. Ultimately, Bonnie was hit with 8 charges of theft and 1 charge of arson related to the Molotov cocktail. Court documents show that Bickford stole funds over a 3-year period from September of 92 to the end of December of 95. Other charges allege that Bickford wrote checks to herself, ranging from $585 to $1,500, and on at least one occasion, she wrote a check to the previously mentioned relative in the amount of $2,750, which she then cashed and used herself. No one knew exactly where all of the money had gone. Asked about Bonnie's potential connection to Walter's murder, Assistant A.G. LaPlante replied, quote, the investigation into the homicide of Walter Page is continuing. The Manchester Police Department and the investigators from this office continue to investigate the circumstances surrounding the death of Walter Page in the hope of formally charging some individual at the appropriate time. End quote. Bonnie was transferred to the Valley Street Jail, where she was held pending trial. While it appeared the wheels of justice were moving, 1995 would end with a tragic hole being left in the Page family, who wanted to see justice done for their father and husband. 3 months later, on Wednesday, March 20th, 1996, bail was reduced from $500,000 to $150,000. Senior Assistant Attorney General Michael Ramsdell requested the reduction in bail, noting that, given the charges, $500,000 was unfair. Judge Robert J. Lynn agreed, though he set conditions for bail should Bonnie come up with the money. She would be required to report daily to the probation department. She would be barred from receiving a passport and would not be allowed to leave the state of New Hampshire. Caroline Smith, a public defender working for Bickford, argued that the state had no evidence tying her client to the murder or the fire and that she was not a flight risk, saying that yes, she had fled the area, but had returned to face up to what she'd done. Prosecutors, however, pointed out that Bonnie had returned because she was arrested and brought back. She hadn't done so of her own free will. Ramsdell noted that she tried to conceal her license plate number and had burned her car, which he believed had been done to destroy potential evidence. Then she faked having amnesia to try and fool Weir police, who arrived at the scene. Ramsdell explained, quote, it's absolutely absurd to argue that she is not a risk of flight or that she was not devious. Devious, a risk of flight, and dangerous. End quote. 6 months later, in September of 1996, more than 9 months after Walter's murder, Bonnie appeared in court again. This time she pleaded guilty to arson and theft charges. According to the indictments, on 2 occasions Bonnie had redeemed association certificates of deposit, one for $57,786.40 and another for $48,355.66. None of that money has been located or recovered. The arson charge was connected to the Molotov cocktail, though at the time, prosecutors could not bring charges against Bonnie for Walter's murder, though they noted she was considered the prime suspect. The court accepted Bonnie's guilty plea and scheduled sentencing to take place 2 months later. On Wednesday, November 6th, Bonnie was sentenced to serve 5 to 10 years in state prison for the theft of $109,000. While she had pleaded guilty to the arson charge, it wasn't pressed at the time, and due to a lack of evidence, no charges related to Walter could be filed. Investigators, however, told the union leader that they believe Walter was killed likely because he had uncovered evidence of Bonnie's embezzlement, and he had to be silenced before he could go to the police. While no evidence was found connecting Carl to either the money or the murder, Conrad Ekdahl struggled to accept his total innocence, telling reporters, quote, "He also received the monthly statements from the banks where these accounts were kept, and either neglected to look at the statements as they came in, allowing Bonnie's actions to go unnoticed, or purposefully ignored or covered up the unauthorized withdrawals by Bonnie. The checks were signed by Carl Bickford, although Bonnie Bickford may have forged her husband's signature." End quote. For the Page family, seeing Bonnie behind bars was a step in the right direction, but they wanted to see her charged for Walter's murder. 1996 had been a difficult year for them, with Danette explaining that, in the months following the murder and fire, her mother had bounced around between different relatives and friends' homes. A strong, vibrant woman, Faye was determined to have the family home rebuilt, but first, it would have to be torn down. The fire and oil damage had been so extensive that there was no other choice. In July, just a week before the house was to be torn down, Faye suffered a massive stroke. The stress had been too much for her, and as a result of the stroke, she'd had to relearn how to swallow and talk. She was moved into an assisted living facility, and doctors said they believed she would be mostly recovered in a year. Frustrated, heartbroken, and angry, Danette expressed her family's point of view, saying, quote, "It troubles me that we live in a society where, as time goes on, more and more people are not held accountable for their actions. Obviously, my family wants someone to be held accountable for what happened to my father and mother. In a couple of hours, she lost her husband of 50 years and her home of 45 years. This is the antithesis of everything we know. This is something we read about elsewhere. This kind of experience just catapults us into a kind of horror, and we think about how things used to be. Obviously, they'll never be the same. Clearly, this isn't the Manchester we were raised in." End quote. While the investigation into Walter's murder had spanned a year, investigators found themselves once again facing the roadblock they'd encountered early on. The fire had destroyed any physical evidence, and without a witness, someone who knew of the crime, or a confession from their prime suspect, they weren't able to move forward with any charges. Manchester Police Chief James Stewart appealed to the public, telling the union leader, quote, "We're still looking for anybody with information. We feel there is a person out there who does have information and maybe is afraid to come forward with it. We really would like to hear from that person." End quote. Sadly, time began passing, and with each year, the anniversary of Walter's murder lingered so close to Christmas that the family couldn't help but grieve during his favorite holiday season. They were dealt another devastating blow 3 years later, in June of 1999, when Faye passed away at the age of 78. She had hoped to see justice done in her lifetime, but the pain and grief of Walter's murder, the destruction of their home, and a lack of progress on the case had weighed heavily on her. Danette and her brothers believe Faye died of a broken heart 3.5 years after Walter's murder. Just over a year later, in July of 2000, Bonnie Bickford went before Judge James Barry Jr. in Hillsborough County Superior Court to request an early release. According to court records, over the previous 4 years, Bickford had managed to pay back the money she owed in restitution, and prosecutors had previously agreed that, should she pay it back, they would not oppose her filing for early release. Danette, however, attended this hearing, later explaining, quote, "We were there because we wanted to remind Bonnie we're still around. We haven't forgotten because we believe she is the person who murdered our father. Early parole, we don't want to see that happen. They say she's been a model prisoner, volunteered, which is, I guess, how it's supposed to go. But that's not where we want the focus to be. We want her to tell us what happened and admit to what she did. In my mind, Bickford not only killed my father, she killed my mother, too. My mom died a year ago after a 3.5-year struggle following a massive stroke she suffered 6 months after my father died. The horror, the grief, broke her heart." End quote. Also attending the hearing were Manchester Police Chief James Stewart and Captain Richard O'Leary, both of whom had been involved in Walter's investigation. Chief Stewart explained their presence to the Nashua Telegraph, saying, quote, "We were there because we are still investigating the death of Walter Page. We are still very much interested in Bonnie Bickford," end quote. Less than a week later, in early August, Judge James Barry Jr. granted a six-month sentence reduction to Bickford. Originally, she wouldn't have become eligible for parole until December 17th, but with this reduction, if parole was granted, she could be out of prison by the end of the month. Asked about the likelihood of her being paroled, Parole Board Executive Director John Eckert explained that she had thus far been a model prisoner, and they couldn't reject parole simply because someone was a suspect in a crime. He explained they would need hard evidence to deny parole, saying, quote, "Without anything pending, we don't have anything we can legally do," end quote. On Thursday, August 17th, a parole board hearing was called to review Bonnie's case and to consider whether or not she should be released early. Chief Mark Driscoll was present at the hearing and expressed the feelings of law enforcement, saying, quote, "I feel it's a great injustice to have Bonnie Bickford return to the city of Manchester to basically be a free woman. I think she is a treacherous person who has demonstrated through her actions that she was a threat to the community. I see no evidence that anything has changed. We are very, very much opposed to parole. We believe she continues to be a threat to our community," end quote. Chief Stewart was also there, noting that he spent 7 hours interrogating Bonnie, who he described as crafty and calculating. The three-person parole board was made up of Nick Hart, George Iverson, and Chairman Amy Varenberg. Varenberg described Bonnie as a meek, docile person who had a very good experience in prison and noted that she saw no reason to deny parole. While she argued that Bickford had been found guilty of nonviolent offenses, Chief Stewart retorted that there was also arson and several members of the Masonic community had been threatened. The arson charge, however, had been deferred and was arranged so that while Bonnie hadn't been sentenced for it, should she violate her parole, she would have to go before a judge for that charge. Ultimately, Bonnie was granted parole, with the board noting that she would be under intensive supervision and would have to adhere to a curfew for her first 90 days, and any crime or parole violation in the next 2 years would see her return to prison. Bickford did appear before the board, though she didn't speak. She had previously explained that upon release, she'd be moving into an apartment with her husband, Carl. A letter was presented to the board, written by Bickford, but it wasn't read into the record. Captain O'Leary was furious, saying, quote, "That's wrong. We certainly should have heard from the defendant. Let's have everything open. Is there any remorse? We don't know," end quote. Asked for her thoughts on the release, Danette told the union leader, quote, "I'm scared that she's going to be back on the streets. The main reason I wasn't there today was emotionally, I couldn't handle it anymore. Going in there and hearing what a model prisoner she's been. My brothers and I have lost both our parents in the last 5 years. It's been really hard for us to see Bonnie Bickford go free. She can have her freedom back. We can't have our parents back," end quote. Chief Stewart mocked the board for believing that Bonnie was anything resembling a meek or docile person, later stating, quote, "The arson was directly involved with the theft of the money. She was very calculating the way she went about it. We know what she gets up to, what she has always been up to," end quote. Law enforcement noted that Bonnie remained the prime and only suspect in Walter's murder. Chairman Varenberg, however, explained that you can't hold Bonnie accountable for crimes she's never been charged with, saying, quote, "We can't go back and sort of relitigate for somebody like her who has completed such an exemplary time in prison. There really is no reason to hold her back," end quote. Asked for his thoughts on Varenberg's statement, Chief Driscoll explained to the Bangor Daily News, quote, "As policemen, we look at it a different way. Crimes are committed against people. If you think the crime was taking money, fine, she's been a wonderful person. But we know Bonnie. We know her psyche. We know what she's up to," end quote. 4 months later, on Thursday, December 14th, 2000, the reward being offered for information leading to an arrest in Walter's murder broke the state record for being the highest amount ever offered. While Crime Lines of New Hampshire had previously set up a $5,000 reward, the Page family added an additional $55,000, bringing the total to $60,000. At the news conference announcing the increased reward, Chief Driscoll noted that they believe someone in the community had information about the crime, and they implored that individual to come forward. Danette was also present, making a small statement in which she acknowledged 5 years had passed and it was time for someone to bring new information to them. Unfortunately, no new information seems to have been brought to light, and following Bonnie's release from prison, the investigation into Walter's death seemingly stalled. 5 years later, December of 2005, marked 10 years since Walter had been murdered and his home set on fire. Asked about progress on the case, Deputy Chief Richard O'Leary told the union leader that the case was still open and would remain open until someone was charged. Asked about Bonnie Bickford, O'Leary replied, quote, "Off and on, I've spoken to her, and another investigator has as well. I promised her that this is a case that will not be forgotten. A lot of evidence was burned in the huge fire, and there were not a lot of people involved. It's very important that people realize we don't give up. Sometimes we just need a lucky break," end quote. Danette, also speaking to reporters on the somber anniversary, expressed her frustration, believing that the killer had been released and was now free to live her life. She explained the anniversary, saying it was, quote, "a reminder to everybody that the person or persons who committed this heinous crime is out on the street, walking around, and probably celebrating Christmas with their grandchildren, something my parents were robbed of," end quote. While Bonnie did not elect to speak with reporters, it's noted that she continued to deny any involvement in the murder. 4 years later, in 2009, New Hampshire's Cold Case Unit was formed. At the time, Walter's family took heart, believing that finally their father's case was going to break open. Unfortunately, while investigators re-examined the files, they seemingly came to the same conclusions: that Bonnie Bickford was the prime suspect, but no physical evidence existed that could give them the ability to file any charges. Once again, Walter's case began growing cold, and soon, days turned to weeks, weeks to months, and months to years. December of 2015 marked 20 years since Walter was murdered, and while no new evidence had been found, cold case investigators told the media that the case is very solvable. They just need that one piece of information to get things moving. Sadly, there has seemingly been no major progress on the case over the nearly 27 years that have passed since that brutally cold, horribly violent day in December of 1995. WMUR Channel 9 New Hampshire conducted several interviews for a story on Walter's case, which was aired in September of 2018. One of the people interviewed was Susan Morell, New Hampshire's Senior Assistant Attorney General. Asked about the case and the lack of progress, she explained, quote, "Somebody had access to Mr. Page's home. Either somebody broke in and this was a robbery gone wrong, or maybe this was somebody he knew and was expecting and let into the house. We can't really narrow it down any further than that right now, because the home was essentially destroyed in the fire. We have limited information to go on," end quote. Also interviewed were Todd and Danette. Todd made a plea to the killer to come forward and admit what they had done, to be honest and help alleviate the tremendous burden of grief. Danette was more direct and emotional in her statement, saying, quote, "My dad did not deserve what happened to him. He was a good man. Let us have closure. Stop our pain. Before we leave this earth, it's the least we could do for our parents. The least we could do," end quote. 1 year later, in December of 2019, Danette and her brother Rick, this time, spoke to the New Hampshire union leader. Here they expressed their growing frustration that after more than two decades, there had been no movement on the case, no charges filed, nothing. Danette stated, quote, "Nothing has been done for almost a quarter of a century, not a thing. We've just been meeting and talking and writing letters and wishing hope upon hope that something is going to give and that the Attorney General's office and the state of New Hampshire will come through and provide us with the accountability and closure that we demand at this point," end quote. Rick called for the case to be reopened and for a new investigation to dig back into it, hoping that with new technology and the passage of time, perhaps they could find something that had previously been missed. Unfortunately, this is where the case remains today. 76-year-old Walter Harriman Page was stabbed at least a dozen times in the basement office of the Page family home on Thursday, December 14, 1995. Sometime after the stabbing, the assailant set the house on fire, leading to a large oil tank explosion that engulfed the house in flames, destroying decades of memories, photographs, and the house where Walter and Faye had lived for 45 years. Today, Bonnie Bickford is 75 years old and living in New Hampshire, just 1 year younger than Walter was when he was brutally murdered. She has never been charged, nor has she ever spoken about the murder publicly. It seems that, following her release from prison, she steered clear of the law and has not been arrested for any other crimes. There is nothing which can ever assuage the grief of the Page family, nor restore Walter and Faye to the lives they should have continued to live. Frustrated, Danette told WMUR Channel 9 how difficult it was to slowly realize that maybe she wouldn't see the crime solved in her own lifetime, saying, quote, "Someone stabbed my dad 12 times. For them to be out there and for us to not have closure and find out what happened is unconscionable. Whoever did this has no courage. No courage. To just kill somebody and then burn the house down and just take off." End quote. Todd, however, took a more somber approach, thinking of the warm and loving memories he had with his parents. He expressed a tender awareness that nothing could ever change what had been done, though he believes they can never give up on fighting for truth, to seek justice for Walter and Faye, to see someone face a judge for the horrible crimes they committed. Asked about the rawness of that pain and the feelings of helplessness, Todd replied, quote, "It's always going to be there. It will always haunt you, because it really wasn't fair to them. They were honest people. Nobody deserves to have something like this happen to them." Making content is an essential part of what I do to keep this show going, but it hasn't always been a seamless creative process. Whether it's putting videos together, making graphics for social media posts, or updating the website, it can be an overwhelming task. I used to just want to scream with frustration, but ever since I found Canva Pro, I can design anything like a pro on any device. Canva Pro is a design platform that empowers you to create and share stunning content in just a few clicks. Designing with Canva Pro is amazingly fast and fun. Choose from thousands of templates that are easy to customize or start from scratch. Canva Pro has endless premium fonts, photos, videos, and so much more that add personality and edge to whatever you're designing. Among the many amazing items available, you have access to one of my favorites, the ability to upload your own fonts. There's even a brand kit to help you create branding for your company or project, uniform across all platforms. Designing together has also never been easier. Sharing, editing, and commenting in real time, Canva Pro helps you stay organized, on the same page, and on top of team projects. No more misplaced files or tedious back and forth. Plus, you and your teammates can unlock everything Canva Pro has to offer for just $12.99 a month. With Canva Pro's content planner, you'll save time planning, creating, and posting social media content too. You can even pause scheduled posts and edit them at any time. My favorite Canva Pro feature is Magic Resize, where I can instantly resize my designs into any content format. Putting together YouTube thumbnails, images for social media, and for posting on the website, it can be really frustrating to have to size and resize things over and over to get them just right. But with Canva Pro, the quality never falters, and I can make any image I need fit the dimensions for my project. Design like a pro with Canva Pro. Right now, you can get a free 45-day extended trial when you use my promo code. Just go to canva.me/trace to get your free 45-day extended trial. That's canva.me/trace. canva.me/trace. I think we've all seen commercials and visited sites that offer DNA tests to unlock the mysteries of our pasts. While that's always a fun and interesting thing to do, It's not uncommon to receive surface-level results leaving you wanting more answers, and that's where Genome Link comes in. Genome Link aims to help people get the most value out of their genetic results. Genome Link doesn't perform DNA tests. Instead, they use those test results to provide more in-depth information based on that person's genetics. Genome Link has a team of dedicated researchers who have curated over 10,000 genetic studies to build a database and algorithm for accurate DNA genetic testing. In layman's terms, they're working hard to stay ahead of the curve with the most recent developments in the genomics field and to help you connect with the most recent and relevant genetic research. Don't just settle for your basic DNA analysis. Upload your DNA test results from anywhere like Ancestry, 23andMe, or MyHeritage and find out what makes you, well, you. We all know that DNA testing has helped solve many unsolved crimes. Genome Link can provide you with in-depth information about yourself and your ancestry. Genome Link analyzes your raw DNA data and gives you access to many more results and information that isn't provided by companies when you get your original DNA test. Personal trait reports provide you with personalized advice for fitness, nutrition, mental well-being, and even skincare. Genome Link is set up in accordance with the requirements of the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, or HIPAA, the federal level security standards for safeguarding protected health information, so your information is safe and secure. Discover your full genetic potential by uploading your existing DNA test results at genomelink.io. Get access to over 25 free trait reports and receive your results instantly. No trial period, no credit card, and no hidden fees. Go to genomelink.io. Sign up today and discover your full genetic potential. This episode is sponsored by Surfshark. Have you ever noticed that it seems like the internet is getting more dangerous by the second? Well, that's because it is. Hackers have more ways to target you. Trackers are following your every move, and malware is hiding all over the web. Luckily, there's a solution. You can get a VPN. A VPN will hide your real location, making you more difficult to identify and target, but privacy and security are not all that Surfshark has to offer. If you use a VPN, you can forget about geo restrictions. You ever watch a video and get confronted by a message that it isn't available in your area? Well, with Surfshark, you'll be able to access everything from news sources to social media apps that are unavailable to you because of your location. Just change your virtual location and access all the entertainment you want safely and securely. So try Surfshark risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Get Surfshark VPN at surfshark.deals/trace. Enter promo code TRACE for 83% off and 3 extra months free. That's surfshark.deals/trace. Use promo code TRACE for 83% off and 3 extra months free. surfshark.deals/trace, promo code TRACE. This year will mark 27 years since Walter Page was brutally murdered before his killer set a fire, destroying the home where he and his wife had lived, raised their children, and spent the previous 45 years of their lives. For more than a quarter century, Walter's killer has eluded authorities and been able to move forward with life, something they robbed Walter and his family of. While they're free to celebrate holidays, have family dinners, and live life the way they want, the Page family has lingered in a dark cloud of grief, anger, and pain. Walter didn't get to watch his grandchildren grow up. He wasn't there to see them graduating and creating their own lives. His beloved wife, Faye, suffered a debilitating stroke and just a few short years later passed away. From nearly the first moment of the investigation, authorities knew something was off about this case. Walter received a threat, saying someone was going to bomb his house the same day he's planning on having a meeting with Carl Bickford and Conrad Ekdahl to go over the financial reports, most specifically, to decide what to do with a $109,000 investment and to determine how a $5,000 overdraft occurred on that account. Ekdahl returns home to find a poorly set Molotov cocktail waiting inside of his door. Less than 48 hours later, Walter is brutally stabbed and the house set ablaze around him, destroying any evidence that might help identify the killer. It doesn't take much to determine that the call Walter received was a smokescreen, an attempt to point the blame towards René Lemaire, despite the fact that Walter hadn't been involved in that investigation at all. While police initially thought this all had been done seeking retribution, it soon became apparent that this was not about a crime which had already been prosecuted, but about keeping a separate crime from being discovered. In the previous few years, Lemire had been arrested and charged with embezzling funds from the Masonic home. Leonard Newell Sr. had also served time and made restitution for his own theft of funds from Masonic dues. What's the old saying? Things come in threes. Well, out of the entire Masonic organization, it appears if there was one person you didn't want going over the finances, it was Walter Page. Highly intelligent, thorough, and knowledgeable about the world of finance, he wasn't the type to notice an irregularity and ignore it. He was a focused individual, someone who would follow the trail to wherever it might lead, and once he knew something was up, he'd definitely be in contact with the police. It seems that, somehow that day, someone became aware that Walter was beginning to dig, and they didn't want him to find what they'd worked to conceal. The threatening call comes in, but Walter isn't dissuaded in his pursuit, perhaps because, in part, the caller accused him of having been involved in the Lemire case, which he wasn't. So if the intent of that threat was to push him off the trail, it failed to have any effect at all. So Walter finds that $5,000 overdraft. It's the first clue that there's some kind of inconsistency going on with the Washington Lodge account, the account he had previously managed for 25 years, an account he'd invested a lot in during his tenure, growing it from $50,000 to several hundred thousand. This wasn't just a financial audit. This was a personal matter, and from everything we know about Walter, he wasn't going to give up until he figured it out. Being the bright guy that he was, maybe in the beginning he thought it could be a mistake. That kind of thing can happen from time to time. But there's no doubt once he discovered the missing check from the book Carl Bickford was in possession of, he knew something more was going on. We don't know how exactly the conversation went at Walter's home that Tuesday night, but I don't think it would be difficult to imagine Walter would have expressed his intent to get to the bottom of it. Less than 48 hours later, Walter is killed and his home is set on fire. So we're confronted with what is one of the most pertinent questions in this case. Did someone break into the house and covertly attack Walter, or did someone come by and Walter let them in? In the years since his murder, there's been some speculation that the killer may have visited Walter in an attempt to throw him off the trail. When that didn't work, they may have turned to threats or even begging. When Walter stood by his intentions to find the truth, the killer lashed out. I can't help but wonder, did the killer bring the knife with them, knowing all along what they were going to do? Or was the knife retrieved from elsewhere in the home after all attempts to change Walter's mind had failed? I tend to lean towards the killer bringing the knife with them, if for no reason other than it would have been difficult to argue with Walter in the basement, go upstairs, grab a knife, and return to kill him without him knowing something suspicious was going on. The next detail of the crime I wonder about is the ruptured oil tank, the one which caused the fire to be as ferocious and destructive as it eventually became. In every account, it simply stated that the tank ruptured and exploded, but I can't help but ask, did it rupture due to damage caused by the fire? Was it old and wearing out? Or is it possible the killer ruptured the tank, knowing how extensive the damage would be, partially covering up the murder, and destroying all physical evidence investigators would need to solidly identify the assailant? That's a question I don't have an answer to, but I think it might be important. Considering we have only one suspect in this case who openly admitted to lighting a Molotov cocktail filled with lamp oil, the similarity isn't completely lost on me. After murdering Walter, this person would have needed to get out of the house and into their vehicle to escape. Being that this was a stabbing, it isn't difficult to imagine that they'd have likely been splashed in blood, which might have then transferred to the interior of the car. Could this be why the prime suspect in this case later crashed her car only to see the interior miraculously catching fire? Perhaps, but I think it's also worth noting that while one prime suspect exists, there's a lingering belief that more than one person could have been involved. Maybe someone who knows Walter. Maybe Walter believed he could trust this person. They go by the house, he lets them in. From there, they could have committed the murder themselves, or maybe they unlock a door and let someone else in. Sadly, regardless of how strong and in shape Walter was, it's likely not that difficult to overpower a 76-year-old man who's hit by a total sneak attack. So what ends up happening? Investigators quickly dismiss the alleged connection to Renee Lemire. They rule out Leonard Newell. Now it becomes clear this crime was absolutely about covering up something that had yet to be discovered. Detectives interview Carl and Bonnie Bickford, and less than 24 hours later, Bonnie flees. For reasons passing understanding, she calls and confesses to her sister about the embezzlement and the Molotov cocktail. She drafts letters, one to her husband, one to police, one to her parents. As she hits the road, she mails the letter and includes her wedding ring in the package, admitting to her husband in his letter that she did steal the money. Strangely, she doesn't run far, just 20 or so miles away, and she's caught that weekend. Her car is crashed, her license plate has been altered, the vehicle's on fire, and she claims to have amnesia. I can't help but ask, if you're already admitting to your sister, your husband, your parents, and the police that you stole $109,000, what the hell are you running for in the first place? Most of the time, people try and get away before anything can be proven. I'd argue it's rather rare to admit to a crime while in the midst of running from the law. While Bonnie only ever made it as far as Weir, investigators believe she was working on trying to get to Georgia. Much like the failure of the Molotov cocktail and the inability to conceal the embezzlement, if there's one thing that seems apparent, it's that while Bonnie may be cold and calculating as investigators have described her, she's not exactly brilliant. Running the way she did is basically the equivalent of holding up a giant glowing neon sign saying that you need to be looked at as a suspect in the murder as well. From there, Bonnie's arrested and brought back to Manchester. She goes before the judge and is denied bond. She's interviewed by investigators for approximately 7 hours, during which time she admits to several crimes. Stealing from the Masonic Association, making threatening phone calls to Walter and other Masons, and setting the Molotov cocktail at Ekdahl's home. When she's asked about the murder and the arson at the Page home, she denies any involvement or knowledge of it. A few months later, she agrees to plead guilty to theft and arson. Maybe she's not as dumb as I thought. Did she plead guilty to those crimes because she knew she'd be found guilty had she gone to trial? Or is it possible she took a guilty plea because she believed a trial might shine a light on her alleged involvement in Walter's murder? In the end, it worked out for her. She gets a sentence of 5 to 10 years, whereas a murder charge would have had her facing the rest of her life behind bars. I guess the question I have is, if you were prepared to admit to it anyway, why did Walter need to die? This is something people have speculated about for years, and it's an argument some have used to lend credence to the possibility that maybe Bonnie herself was not the one who murdered Walter and set the house on fire. Now, I have no way of knowing for certain what exactly happened here, and I know it's easy to get caught up in the trappings of something seeming so obvious when maybe something else was really going on. I am willing, however, in at least this case, to say I would be absolutely astounded were evidence ever found to show that Bonnie Bickford wasn't involved in this crime. I wouldn't be shocked to learn someone else was also involved, but considering 27 years have passed and another suspect has never surfaced, no other clues have ever been brought up, and only Bonnie remains the prime suspect, it's hard to see it another way. To quote another old saying I'm rather partial to, 3 people can keep a secret if 2 of them are dead. It's hard to believe, after all this time, something wouldn't have spilled out if someone else had been involved or was entirely responsible. Maybe that's my own bias showing. Maybe it's just following the logical paths laid out before me. I try to approach cases straight up the middle. What evidence do we have? What are the theories? What makes the most sense and what can be connected together? It's like the Romans used to ask, qui bono? Who benefits? One of the first things you consider when examining a murder is motive. Who would want this person dead? The way I see things in this case, there's really only 2 people who could have wanted Walter gone. Bonnie Bickford and maybe her husband Carl. The latter, of course, presupposes that Carl knew his wife was embezzling money and would want to protect her from being charged. We don't have any evidence that Carl knew. He was never charged, he cooperated with police, and his own statements were used to build a case against Bonnie. To me, what stands out is the meeting itself. 3 people were there that night. Walter, Ekdahl, and Bickford. Of those 3, Ekdahl gets a Molotov cocktail. Walter is murdered. Nothing happens to Carl. It seems quite clear that of this group, there's 1 of them the killer doesn't wish to harm or threaten. I also think it's worth noting that Walter receives the threatening phone call before the meeting happens. Who would have known about it, besides these three men and their wives and maybe their secretaries or business associates? Was the call made to warn Walter about what was coming, or was it done with the hope that he wouldn't bring up the possible embezzlement? You could even stretch it a little further. Perhaps the Molotov cocktail at Ekdahl's home wasn't meant to create a massive fire, but to send a message. Maybe the killer believed that when Walter heard about it, he might be a little less likely to risk his own life in pursuit of the truth. You go from a threatening phone call to a Molotov cocktail to brutal murder? There had to have been something that caused things to escalate. Was it Carl coming home and telling Bonnie about the irregularities on the account? Or was it someone going to see Walter, at which time he may have directly accused them of being responsible for the missing money? It's hard to say. But when you give this case a 1,000-foot overview, it's really an instance where, seemingly, absolutely everything is pointing in only one direction. Did Bonnie Bickford kill Walter and set his house on fire? Was she perhaps involved in another way, maybe starting the fire, but not having done the stabbing? Could someone else have been involved? The possibilities here are, surprisingly, not endless. There's only so many ways this could have gone down, and while neither the police nor myself can prove it, the one consistent factor is Bonnie. She's married to Carl, so she knows about the meeting. Carl, perhaps shocked to learn that there's an overdraft and a missing check from the book, brings it up. Now she knows they're looking at that account, and at some point it's going to lead to her. Ekdahl's house is targeted. Then comes Walter. The connection is clear. Three men present at an important meeting, two are targeted, and the one who isn't is married to the woman who later admits to stealing the money, placing the Molotov cocktail, and threatening Walter. I suppose we're just meant to believe that it's all some bizarre coincidence. Why, yes, I put the Molotov cocktail there, and I stole the money, and I threatened to bomb Walter's house, but I'm certainly not the one who actually killed him and set his house on fire. A leads to B leads to C doesn't lead to D. Maybe I can't always see the forest for the trees, but it seems like in this case, you'd have to have your eyes closed to miss all of the connections. Being that there's only one real theory in this case and one actual suspect, there aren't a lot of different avenues to explore. I think one of the most important things to observe is not so much what happens before and during a crime, and maybe not so much immediately after, but how things progress from that time on. What bonds are broken? Who goes their separate ways, and who stands together? While it carries no evidentiary value to this case, I can't help but acknowledge that, after admitting to her crimes, after serving time in prison, when Bonnie Bickford is released, she moves into an apartment with Carl, and seemingly they've remained together ever since. Maybe it's just me, but if my wife stole from my lodge for years, hid it from me, and put me in a position to look the fool when questions started being asked, it's safe to say I'd be looking for a new wife. How can a relationship continue when trust has been shattered in such a massive and devastating way, whether you believe she was involved in Walter's murder or not? Some things are simply unacceptable. But maybe that's my own flaws. Maybe there's a love out there that's so strong, so powerful, so wonderful that if my wife betrayed me in such a massive way, I'd be counting down the seconds until she was released from prison and we could be together again. Maybe Carl's just a really devoted husband who can see past any choices Bonnie makes, good or bad, or maybe he's found some way to excuse her crimes. Maybe he doesn't believe she killed Walter, or maybe he knows more than he's ever said. And if we knew the true depth of what was going on with the embezzlement and the murder, we'd find that Bonnie was not the only person who knew what was coming. Unfortunately, as the matter stands today, all we can really say for certain is that Bonnie Bickford stole $109,000, which has never been recovered, made threatening phone calls, placed a Molotov cocktail on one man's doorstep, and then, by sheer coincidence, the man she threatened was brutally murdered and his home was burned to the ground. If you truly believe that, then I've got some amazing swampland I'd love to sell you. When you're looking at a case with no evidence, it's frustrating. When you're looking at a case with no suspects, it's overwhelming. When you're looking at a case with one suspect and a slew of circumstantial evidence to the point where it seems like almost nothing else is possible, there isn't even a word to describe that. Can you imagine what it must have been like to have worked on this case and to have watched as Bickford got early release and then moved on with her life? To believe you're staring into the eyes of a killer, but knowing there's absolutely nothing you can do about it. Take that a step further. Imagine it was someone you loved who was killed in this way. Could you handle things the way Danette, Rick, and Todd have? I admire them, not just for their determination to see justice done, but for their ability to suppress all the urges that I would have for revenge, because I'm not nearly as strong as they are. So that's where we end up. After all the court proceedings, interviews, questions, and searches for clues and evidence, an alleged killer walks free after serving 4 years and a family left devastated in the wake of what had to have been the worst nightmare they could have never even imagined possible. The Pages didn't just lose their father. They lost the home they grew up in, the memories and mementos of their childhoods, and just a few years later, their mother, who simply couldn't bear the burden any longer. It's one of the most egregious crimes I've ever covered on Trace Evidence, and I can't begin to express just how fucking angry this makes me. The truth is, this has always been in someone else's hands. Police believe there's someone out there who knows more about Walter's murder. The family believes that someone currently in or formerly of the Manchester community holds the key to helping them along the path of healing. To see Walter's killer named, arrested, charged, and prosecuted can't bring Walter back, but it's certainly easier to heal a wound that's dressed as opposed to one that's open and raw. Nearly 27 years later, hasn't enough time passed? Haven't they been through enough? If you know who killed Walter, it's time to speak up. Send an anonymous letter. Send a text to Crime Stoppers. Tell what you know. Because without someone coming forward, the discovery of new evidence or a confession, the murder of Walter Page will remain open, unsolved, and growing cold. If you're looking for more information about the murder of Walter Page, the Nashua Telegraph, Boston Globe, and the New Hampshire Union Leader had the most extensive coverage in newspaper archives. There are some posts about the case online, but they're few and far between. If you have any information about the murder of Walter Page, please contact the New Hampshire Cold Case Unit at 603-271-2663. You can also email them at coldcaseunit@dos.nh.gov. You can also contact the Manchester Crime Line at 603-624-4040. You can visit their website at manchestercrimeline.org, where you can also submit tips directly online. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, or comment in the Facebook group. Just a quick reminder that I'll be attending CrimeCon in Las Vegas representing Trace Evidence on Podcast Row. To save 10% off your pass, use promo code TRACE at CrimeCon.com. Trace Evidence would not be possible without support from amazing listeners like you. And now I'd like to take a moment to thank our fantastic Patreon producers, Alicia Lorraine, Anne Bertram, Brittany Bivens, Christine Greco, Krista Colvin, Denise Dingsdale, Donna Buttram, Diane Dyson, Eamon Brady, Eloanne Meyer, Eric Sumpter, Guillerme Pinto, Haley Christie, James, Jen Treb, Jennifer Winkler, Jill Sense, Joni Berkowitz, Julie Mangano, Kara Moreland, Lars Jensen Fangel, Leslie B., Marla Wright, Melissa Brakeisen, Nick Mohar Schurz, Orange Patches, Quinn McBreen, Roberta Jansen, Sarah Levinen, Sarah Lyons, Travis Skepko, Stacy Finnegan, Stephanie Joyner, Stephanie Eve, Adorable Susie Summers, Taylor, Tom Archer, Tom Radford, and Tracy Woods. Your contributions to Trace Evidence are invaluable, and your support of the show is both appreciated and extremely humbling. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence and gaining access to exclusive merch and ad-free episodes, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence or go to trace-evidence.com and click on the support option. That concludes this week's episode examining the brutal 1995 murder of Walter Page. I want to thank you again for listening, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence. If you're listening to this audio, it's just here so that I can insert more ads from Spreaker without having to insert them into the main body of the episode. So I apologize if you waited this long just to hear this little piece of audio, but it's really just so that you have to hear less ads during the running of the show. Less ads.